Animals and animal issues have been important to me my whole life. My mom recently found this. It's from 1996. I'm showing this. Here's my animal dedication documented. There I am in the background behind a bunny at an animal rights protest in Austin while I was a graduate student. And they almost spelled my name right there in the caption. So this has been part of my life for a long time, and people have also regularly given me a hard time for it. Sometimes it rolls off my proverbial back, but sometimes it's quite painful and has made me want to hide that part of myself as a defense mechanism. And I've had some friends and people whose opinions mattered to me outright scoff or mock my ethical concern. I recall a specific conversation some years ago. This is way back in my 20s, when I explained that I did not buy or wear silk because I did not want to participate in an industry that boiled cocoons alive to get the material when I had plenty of other options to dress my body. And a friend responded, "Well, only you would think of that. There's nothing wrong with it, and silk feels good." That was just one instance. There were other occasions too where this particular person went out of their way, not simply to just say that the two of us saw an issue differently, but rather to point out that my worldview and ethics were just plain dumb and unmanly. And I felt this person was denigrating me for something that they knew was a key part of my identity. And it hurt because it came from someone who at the time was among my closest friends. And when it became a pattern of behavior, it did drive a wedge in our friendship. The reason I'm telling the story is that my experiences of that sort have some of the hallmarks of microaggression. Psychologist Daryl Dwing Sue defines microaggressions as the everyday verbal, nonverbal, and environmental slights, snubs, or insults, whether intentional or unintentional, that communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative messages to target persons based solely upon their marginalized group membership. The experiences I was alluding to a moment ago describe brief, everyday kinds of exchanges, and they were related to my being part of a group whose ethics and worldview are alternative and marginal. And my experiences were also something that became more painful and harmful when they grew in quantity over time. I've seen microaggressions compared to paper cuts or bruises that one of them may not be so bad, but then when you get a whole lot of them, particularly right when they are in the same place, they compound. So when I've been mocked or denigrated for caring about animals or being vegan, or what it means about my supposed manliness, am I experiencing microaggressions? When I first started to work on the sermon and outline what I was imagining, that question was occurring to me. I knew what microaggressions were, but I wasn't quite clear which side of the fence to put my own experience. So I'm going to raise that question to us. This is what we're going to think through. To whom and to what situations does the term microaggressions apply? The term originated in 1970 from an African-American psychiatrist named Chester Pierce. He used the term to describe the insults and dismissals that he regularly experienced and witnessed non-Black Americans inflicting on African-Americans. So the term originated then being specifically about race and the Black experience. It's recently moved from academia into our general culture, starting in the early 2000s because of the writings of this guy on your screen right now, Dr. Daryl Dwing Sue. He began to use the term in his books, describing any socially marginalized group, including all non-whites, LGBTQ plus people, people living in poverty, people living with a disability. And Dr. Sue noted that the people making the comments may be otherwise well-intentioned and unaware of the potential impact of their words. So in other words, microaggressions are not about intent of the speaker and whether or not they did intend to be harmful. Microaggressions are about their impact. So let's then return to the matter of whose experiences does the term apply to? So I wasn't quite sure about where to put my own experiences. Here's what broke the logjam in my thinking. Last month, a female UU minister invited colleagues who identified or presented as female to post some of the unsolicited advice that they've received about their appearance, supposedly in the guise of, you know, fostering professionalism, that this was going to be good for them as a minister. She kicked it off by noting an occasion when she was a guest preaching as a fat seminarian, and that was her words, fat as a fat seminarian, and that's the first one at the top there. A woman of your size really should take advantage of wearing a preaching robe. It's a perk of the job, being able to cover everything up like that. And you can see we've got a whole bunch there at the top about the minister's appearance being distracting in a variety of ways. That color of lipstick distracts me. Your shoes are too shiny and they distract me. It was a great message, but some congregants had an issue with your outfit and found it distracting. Some others that are just plain rude and hurtful. Since you lost weight, I can see you're actually pretty. You should smile more. Don't dress too butch. It's enough that you're a lesbian who works with children. Don't push it. Here's a bunch from the same person. You look too young to be a preacher. No one will take a thing you had to say from the pulpit because you're pregnant. You should wear skirt suits to preach, not pants. You should wear pants to preach. If you wear dresses or skirts, people want to date you, not listen to you. You shouldn't wear your hair curly. It's distracting. Another minister noted that a new attendee, upon learning that the person next to them was their partner, said, well, there goes that sexual fantasy. And she noted that even worse, none of the men there understood why it bothered her, remarking, oh, I don't think it was about you personally. There were many more. This is just a sample. Some of these remarks came from congregants. Some were from ministers, some of whom were in supervisory or mentoring roles. Many of these remarks, maybe we could say all of them even, are inconsistent with UU values. Some are sexual harassment. They're all rude or insensitive in some way. Some are even just plain creepy and entirely inappropriate. I don't have any doubts that the women among us today couldn't tell us about very similar experiences. It's called sexism and patriarchy. Making remarks about female and femme bodies and gender norms in ways we don't about male bodies is just one manifestation of it. And we all know that sexism shows up in more profound ways as well when it comes to things like equal access and equal pay. So it's in reflecting on this and comparing it with my own experiences, this is what broke the logjam in my thinking. Have I experienced insensitive, rude, and hurtful remarks because of who I am? Yep, I sure have. And sometimes they really hurt and have impacted how I lived and who I was willing to share that part of myself with. The next slide's got a vegan insult, which I must say I've never had leveled at me. I was unaware of what a soy boy was, but apparently this is in cultural currency now. That a soy boy is a guy who's vegan and as a result consumes too much estrogen through soy and is then a total effeminate guy. So I don't know where the heck this pink hat is coming from. And an alt-right guy put the pink hat on all kinds of talk show people suggesting that because they're progressive, they must therefore be effeminate and soy boys. So there are hurtful things that can be leveled against those of us who care about animals. But beyond their emotional impact, I can't imagine it affecting things like my social mobility or getting a loan or equal pay. There probably could be times it could keep me from getting a job, but I'm sure that that's a job I wouldn't want anyway. You know what Tyson or the Pork Council can do with their job from my point of view. So when I started all of this, I think the reason I was initially unclear about whether my own experiences should be called microaggressions or not is because at the surface level, they look a lot alike. But beyond the immediate emotional impact, being treated poorly for my beliefs seems very different from what others experience regarding their gender or their race or their sexuality or their disability. So eventually I came to a point where I was uncomfortable calling them the same thing. Are they similar? Yes, but in my mind, not entirely the same. And that's because issues like sexuality and race have a history of marginalization. And there are considerable issues of power there that are not present for us so-called soy boys. My animal ethics are very precious to me. They're an important part of my identity. But another factor is also the fact that I can choose to keep it to myself. That's often not true for other issues like gender identity or race or disability. So in this particular instance, I feel the best thing for me to do is to step back and say, microaggressions are not something that is universal and applicable to any and all forms of social slights or rudeness or denigrations of our identity. And I'm saying that because I'm feeling that if we put everything into the circle of and call every form of rudeness a microaggression, I think it dilutes the power of the concept. Now, that doesn't mean I can't talk about my experiences about being wounded and harmed for who I am. But I can also use other vocabulary to do it. I just did it. I've been doing it today. It seems that there are identities who need to use the concept of microaggressions a whole lot more than I do. So I'm feeling that that would make me a better ally, is to acknowledge that while we all may have wounds from our everyday interactions, not all of those wounds are equal when we consider the identities that are at stake. People are killed for being trans. That's not a thought or fear that has ever had to cross my mind for being who I am. So I would like to suggest that using the word microaggressions carefully is a way we can all assist marginalized identity, whether we are or are not part of that identity. Well, beyond this, beyond knowing the right time to step in or step back, how else can we work towards minimizing the potential damage of microaggressions? So I've got some more tips for us from the work of Dr. Sue. So the next slide is tip number 2. Be mindful of our impacts. So Dr. Sue says, question some of the things we do or say. And that's for all of us. It is likely a very rare thing that someone is only part of privileged categories or only part of marginalized ones. We're probably going to drift in and out of it at different times, depending on the issue in question. So all of those remarks about how the female minister's appearance was supposedly distracting was all about the speaker and their stuff about gender and female bodies and authority didn't really have anything to do with the minister. So when thoughts like this occur to us, it's worth asking ourselves questions like, am I uncomfortable or anxious or saying things without fully thinking them through? and considering what their impact might be? Is it something that really needs saying? It is far, far easier to add something to a conversation than repair the damage from words that are spoken too hastily. In my own case, most of you know I have a background in African studies. So based on appearance and skin tones and accents and all of those sorts of things, I have a pretty good sense what part of Africa people might be from, particularly if I know their last name. And it's thrilling for me to try and guess where they're from, but all I'm doing is making these people feel uncomfortable and saying, hey, you stick out. Are you an immigrant? Right. So do I really need to satisfy my curiosity or show off my African study cred by saying, hey, you seem like an immigrant. Can I guess where you're from? The impact there could be considerable. What's gained from it? Well, nothing really. So why not just keep that to myself? Tip number three, be open to discussing our biases. There are powerful cultural narratives at work on all of us. In the book, The Welcoming Congregation, Scott Alexander wrote that homophobia is so pervasive in our culture that even queer individuals can be homophobic. Any of us, even if we're part of the marginalized group, are capable of saying harmful things. It's always worthwhile to engage in some self-examination and self-reflection about why we speak and act as we do. When I was working on the sermon, I asked a few women in my life, have you had some experiences like these female ministers? As I'm sure you could guess, they all had. And in fact, none of them had to even think about it for a moment. They had experiences right at the tip of their tongue. And I'm totally confident that the same is true for the women here today. And others of us probably have examples we could provide about classism, mental health stigmas, and on the list can go. And we can all work on rewriting the impact that cultural narratives can have on us and our thinking. Tip number four, the last tip, practice micro-interventions. The concept of microaggressions has come under attack of late as part of the sort of general pushback about so-called cancel culture. Well, Dr. Seuss says microaggressions have resonance. People are using it and want to use it because it describes their experiences so well. For instance, if people are habitually touching or asking to touch a Black woman's hair, obviously something is going on there. And microaggressions describes that experience for her. So microinterventions are suggesting that the best recourse for our society as a whole is to not engage in an attacking or a combative tone that cancels or ostracizes the offending party. Dr. Seuss says, keep in mind, microaggressions are often unintentional or outside of a person's awareness. So the best approach is one that is collaborative and restorational. And this is something that is a burden for all of us to share. It's not just the people who are experiencing the microaggressions. How do we practice a micro intervention? Well, we're going to have to use our life experiences and our intuition and decide what each particular circumstance warrants. I don't think that there's necessarily a universal solution on how to practice a micro intervention. Some degree of rudeness and insensitivity is going to be here to stay. Because after all, miscommunications and misunderstandings are always going to happen. That's part of social reality. We also have to acknowledge that there are people, for a variety of reasons and their own stuff, who often act with rudeness and insensitivity on purpose. But for those of us who cause harm accidentally, we can work toward reducing the harm done to marginalized populations through microaggressions. And we can work towards reducing the power of stereotypical images and old school narratives that those microaggressions are often based on. Sometimes we may be the recipient of a microaggression. Sometimes we might be the originator. We might be a third party witness. But wherever we find ourselves socially positioned, let us all acknowledge and remember that microaggressions are real, and so is their hurt and damage. So it's my wish and my prayer for us all today that we, one, think about when the right time is to step in or step back about our own harms. Be mindful of our impacts. Be open to discussing our biases and practice micro interventions as we are able. With the right intentions and the right aspirations, we can contribute to healthier people who can in turn contribute to other healthier people, all towards building a healthier world. Whether we need the healing or have it to offer, may the world be a gentler and kinder place tomorrow than today. Amen.